I mean, it just seems as if everything, everything in Toronto's gotten screwed up this weekend. Now, I'm not talking about that. There's been plenty of ink and plenty of verbiage spilled about what happened on Friday in this province. I'm talking about sports. I'll leave aside the Blue Jays for a minute and leave aside Toronto FC, who lost 4-2 to Montreal in Orlando. I'm just going to leave that a lot because that's, you know, push and pull of the regular season, et cetera, et cetera. But Tyche, I got to ask you, what the hell are the Raptors doing? I'm dead serious about this. What are they doing? Why don't they understand that they're supposed to lose every game and increase? They can, you know, it's going to come down to a matter. If this team can somehow lose four more games than it wins the rest of the way, they can increase their chances in the draft lottery to like 30%. I don't get this. I don't get why the Raptors aren't just in full-fledged tank mode right now. Because everybody's got a contract, right? Bobby's back. Nick Nurse is back. Fred's here. Pascal's here. There's nothing to play for here. What the hell's going on, Deitch?
Well, here's the problem with the tank game plan. And make no mistake, they can claim otherwise, but they are trying to tank. I mean, you sort of look at the lineup here. The NBA sort of even caught them. But the problem, Jeff, is that, you know, Paul Watson Jr. didn't get the memo. Chris Boucher didn't get the memo. Yuta Watanabe didn't get the memo. Like, these guys are, even if they have contracts, they're playing to impress other teams in the league down the road. They're playing like guys who never get any kind of court time. Malachi Flynn, who really had a terrible first half, I thought, has been fantastic over the last couple games.
Why does he need to be fantastic? He's here next year anyhow.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I think he is playing for more playing time next year. So it's actually been, it's actually an interesting little experiment in that they're basically not playing, you know, they're playing four backups and one starter in most of these games. You know, give or take whoever sort of the starter that game. And those guys have played hard. Now, I think the Thunder, Jeff, are a lousy team. And so you could probably get away with who they started and beat the Thunder if you shoot a little bit. But I'll be curious your take on this too. Well, let's say they get to the point where they're sitting at like, you know, a game ahead of whoever for ninth place. Let's say, I'll just make this up, a game ahead of the Bulls. What do you do for the last 10 games? I mean, do you just all of a sudden go back to VanVleet, Lowry, OG, you know, Pascal or whatever? Or do you continue with this, you know, hodgepodge of guys? Because I think this is going to end up happening. I don't think they're going to lose enough games where they're not out of it with 2 weeks to play. And then if that's the case, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, look, part of me was that was just tongue-in-cheek. I think if you're – I mean, there's a couple of things at work here. Yeah, it takes a certain team to tank. It takes a certain type of team to tank. Now, I remember having a conversation with – I'm giving away a column here, but what the hell. I remember having a conversation with a soon-to-be former NHL general manager at a morning skate. You can tell this is a long time ago because, one – I was a legit journalist then. I was working for a newspaper. And two, there was a morning skate, which there isn't anymore. Three, of course, there was no pandemic. So we were discussing a team in the NHL that we thought was in the process of tanking. And this soon-to-be ex-general manager, and I'm going to protect his identity, but this soon-to-be ex-general manager told me, you guys in the media don't understand this tanking thing. And I thought he was going to go into this whole, you know, there's a morality to running a sports franchise, you know, the legitimacy of the honesty of effort, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, and he didn't go there. He said, here's the thing. And I remember this interview. Here's the thing you need to tank. First of all, you got to have everybody under contract, all your core players. They've got to understand that they can suck and they're still going to be getting $5 million from ownership next year from this team. You have to have some record of recent success on the part of your front office. Because his point was, guys, players will trust you if you have shown them previously that you have what it takes to win, whether it's with that team or with another organization, right? If you bring in a general manager from an organization who's won multiple Stanley Cups and a head coach who's won multiple Stanley Cups, the players are more apt to say, okay, well, these guys have done it before. These guys have done it before, so if they want to do this, then whatever. The third thing is the head coach has got to have job security. Because nobody wants, you know, take the team out and tank, and we'll talk about your contract at the end of the year. Yeah, that ain't going to work. And the other thing, and this is perhaps the most important, the general manager's got to have job security, because if it backfires, right, he's got to know that he's got a couple of years to play with. I was thinking about this, Richard. What team does that sound like to you?
That you check literally every box you just checked off for the Toronto Raptors.
But this is where your point comes in. If it's me, I'm playing those guys when they come back. But because this is going to sound really stupid, I think they probably get it more than Chris Boucher or Utah Watanabe. I think they, you know, and I look around the team. Gary Trent, he's back next year. There's no doubt about that.
But he's playing for big money, so he's going to play hard.
Well, he's going to get his money next year anyhow. He's not a free agent. Is he an RFA?
I'm saying, Jeff, he's either getting $15 million or he's getting closer to $20 million if he continues to put up the numbers he's putting up. So I'm just saying he's incentivized to play hard.
Yeah, maybe.
They don't have that's the problem for them.
Kyle doesn't give a rat's ass.
Yes. You're right about that.
Kyle's going to get his money regardless of whether or not they win a round, go out in the first round, or don't make the playoffs.
The starters on this team would be motivated by pride. They wouldn't be motivated by anything else. The other guys are honestly motivated by money and time. And I think money and time are bigger motivators at this point in the season in a bubble, but in an environment where they're not in Toronto. They've been on the road for 2 years. Mentally, it's got to just be exhausting for them. So, you know, I'm with you on this. I think the guys who are playing now are going to play. This is not to knock the Van Vleets or et cetera. They're playing harder. They're going to play harder than the starters. The other thing, Jeff, and this is something we're not going to know maybe until months down the road, is how much COVID took out of the guys who are out. And are they, you know, Fred Van Vliet has not looked like 100% in months. And same with Pascal, you know, until at least a little recently. And you wonder where these guys are health-wise. But as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at the standings. I mean, you almost have to laugh. They're 2.5 games behind Indiana, Jeff. You know what I mean? They're 4.5 games behind Charlotte. Like, these are not good teams. Like, literally in a week and a half, the Raptors could be the eighth seed.
Yeah, but that's no good.
It's weird.
But that's no good. You don't want to be the eighth seed.
I agree with you. I think long-term, they should tank. I'm just telling you that that conference is so bad
that
it wouldn't take long for them to be in a playoff position. That's all I'm saying.
There you go. That is the great unknown here, or the great uncontrollable, right? We can do what we want, but my God, if there's another team that's, If our plan C is still better than someone else's plan A,
exactly. The Hawks are the fourth seed.
Yeah.
That's not a good team. I mean, that's the problem. This conference is bad. I don't know how else to say it. It's just a bad conference.
It sucks big time. And I got grief for mentioning this. I was on with Tim on Tim and Friends, and I got grief for mentioning this. And somebody said, well, you know, what's the difference between a seventh pick overall or a 10th pick overall? And I said, no, if you do it right, we're talking about improving your chances of getting a top four pick.
Exactly.
And there's a huge drop off in this draft after that.
Yes.
And by the way, you're not going to get better in free agency this year. You're
right.
Not.
My point is, you will probably not have as good a chance to get a top four pick in the next 3 years, right, as you will now.
Bingo.
Because you know, they'll be back in Toronto.
You don't want to suck 2 or 3 years down the road. You want to take, and that's my other point here. This is the only time you can do this, because next year, hopefully at least, you're back in Toronto selling tickets, playing in front of your fans. That's the other thing here. There is nobody watching you. Nobody cares. That's the other thing. No front office, Richard, has had carte blanche the way this front office.
Again, I understand it goes against sort of competitiveness. And yeah, as you mentioned, Blair, I thought very well, this is honestly the year where you would try to get the Tim Duncan move. Like, and again, there's not really a I don't think Cade Cunningham is Tim Duncan. Just sort of hear me out here. But the Spurs actively tanked that year because the draft was good and they were hoping to get a franchise player. There are four players in this draft who, if you talk to most NBA experts, should be perennial all-stars. They may not be transcendent players, but they're all-stars. If you're the Raptors, how else can you get an all-star? You're not getting one through free agency, Jeff. So this is your shot to hopefully get, you know, as low a, you know, your best potential odds for the lottery, and then hope you get lucky with a top four. But then, like last night, that's the, you know, like Chris Boucher goes off for 30 something because he's in a zone and he's getting a ton of time. And, you know, I bet you if you gave truth serum to Masai and Nick, they'd be shaking their head. Like the plan yesterday, I think in all honesty, was to drop one to the Thunder, and it didn't happen.
All right. Let's talk about the Leafs. Speaking of the frustration that unites us. Hey, I'm not worried about this, Richard. Actually, I'm kind of starting to worry a little bit here. You know, I'm happy for the Vancouver Canucks. It's a good story, yada yada, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm feeling a little less secure with Jack Campbell. I don't know about you.
The bloom's a little bit off.
Yeah, I think I might be ready for a new type of soup. I don't know.
Well, you've got two options if you don't go for Jack.
Oof.
We don't know what's going on with Freddie, right? I mean, listen, last night was pretty awful. You can't spin. It's a nice story for the Canucks. And, you know, if we were Vancouver-centric, I think we'd be looking at it much differently. But to me, last night is about what is the severity of Zach Hyman's injury. Like that, you know, I still think there's enough talent on this team where they should win the division unless something really crazy happens. But that, you know, Jeff, the Austin Matthews and Mitch Marners and John Tavares is rightfully get a lot of attention, but I think he's one of the five best players on that team. And he's honestly, he's pretty close to Matthews in terms of guys you can't lose. So I'm hoping that is not as severe as it looked. You know, we heard good things coming out of the locker room, at least from Zach. We'll see today, but that's, yesterday's game, it was ugly, but it really could be catastrophic if he's out for a while.
Yeah, and look, I'm going to, we'll be joined by Ian McIntyre, who covers the Canucks for us in a few minutes. But like, I don't know. I'd be lying if I said I've watched every game Alex Edler's played. So I don't know. I don't know what type of player he is. To me, that was a dirty hit. And now I understand everybody has gone out of their way to point out that, you know, this is, he was going to his bench at the end of a 3-minute shift where he and the Canucks had been hemmed in. And, he was given a 5-minute penalty plus a game misconduct. He's going to have a review, and we're led to believe we'll know more about Zach Hyman maybe even before this show is over. It would be something if this injury turns out to be serious and to be an unintended consequence of the Canucks being rushed back from COVID-19. And I'm not blaming the Canucks here or anything, but what I am saying is, yeah, the Canucks, it was a great story that they came back to win. I really think the NHL is playing with a little bit of fire here when it comes to the Canucks. I really do.
I mean, maybe one of our guests can help us out here, but probably Ian, but you know, I don't know if you look, at the standings, Jeff, they got to make up a lot of games in a short amount of time. You know?
Yeah. I understand this was all collectively bargained. And yeah, I think the smart thing to leave it with the players, but I don't know. We know so little about the long-term impacts of this thing. I would just assume, frankly, if the league had really erred in the side of caution here and essentially, and I understand you can't leave the Canucks shut down for another week or 10 days and then bring them back. That doesn't accomplish anything. At some point you have to make a decision and you either play or you don't play. I get that. I heard somebody say, well, they should have given them a couple more days off. No, at some point you make a decision. The decision is either you play or we shut you down for the rest of the year. Saying we're going to wait another 5 or 6 days, it doesn't make any difference. That doesn't increase the likelihood that they're going to be more competitive. It maybe increases the likelihood that they will be a little healthier, but I'm not certain rest is the issue right now when it comes to this. I think it's sharpness. I just don't know. I don't know if there really is a playbook here for the NHL with this, I guess is what I'm saying.
Do you see any scenario? I mean, it just doesn't strike me. I think these big four sports particularly are really hesitant or reticent to do what, well, we saw like the NWSL did, the Women's Hockey League did, I think MLS did too, right? Like I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do, but I think it would take a lot for them to shut a team down. I'm not even saying it again. It might be the right thing to do. I just think these guys would err on trying to figure out how to make it work, even with a horrible schedule.
Yeah.
Then shut them down. But I'm not, again, you know, epidemiologically or health wise, maybe Ian can educate us more. Maybe that should have been done because you're going to ask these guys after what was very, you know, they dealt with clearly the variant of COVID, Jeff. You're going to ask these guys to play a hell of a lot of games in a row in what is clearly not 100% health. So you are, in some sense, right? You're putting them at some kind of risk to start with.
Yeah.
Injury-wise, at least, I would say.
Yeah, and look, I watched part of that. I found that game hard to watch. It has nothing to do with the outcome of the game. I just didn't think Vancouver was very good. Their goalie was good. But, my God, if that's what I'm going to see out of them. And, again, I love the story. Kudos. Kudos that they were able to win. Great. All that stuff about grit and all that, fine. Wonderful. Kudos to the Canucks for winning that. Oh, man. I just sometimes I think that it's better off not to play than to play.
No, the Leafs, I mean, honestly, if their goalie doesn't stand on his head and, you know, sort of a couple bounces here, that could have been a 6-0 win for the Leafs.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't even close in terms of who was the better team. Now, they absolutely just coughed it up at the end, but that was not close based on, particularly if you look at the analytics for that game. So I think your point is interesting. Like the other thing, Jeff, and both of us have seen this just in covering sports, you know, a lot of times a team coming back from something can give you one really big effort, adrenaline, emotion plays. I'd be really curious, like, what are the Canucks going to be 5 days from now? And
well,
like, that'll tell me something.
And further to that point, my concern with all this, and I think it has to be a concern for the Vancouver Canucks, and I've got to think, you know, and I'm going to give, and I'm sure it's a concern for Gary Bettman and Don LaFleur as well. My concern is, what am I sacrificing in terms of next season with the Vancouver Canucks to get this season done? Like, I don't know how I feel about putting, because this is a team-wide thing. This wasn't one or two players. I don't know how I feel about effectively putting an entire roster in harm's way to finish out this season. I don't know how I can do that without worrying about what the impact is going to be next year. That to me is, it hasn't been talked about enough. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4 players. Look, we've seen teams in every sport have to put 6 guys in the COVID list and they play and they come back and, you know, but that's different than a whole team. And especially when we're talking about a variant, that's the thing that just for some reason doesn't sit right with me. And maybe I'm being Pollyanna-ish here, and I don't think I am. I think I'm a realist when it comes to sports and business. Maybe realist to the, you know, edging towards a pessimist. But, God, I think there's some... I don't think we have been presented with a situation in sports where the broader picture is as broad as it is with the Vancouver Canucks. I guess that's what
I remember we, you know, in 2020, a lot of times on the show, we talked about what happens if an entire team contracts this. You know, what do these leagues do? How do they figure out scheduling? Do they consider shutting them down? And, you know, the NHL has made its decision. And again, I would argue that the first game and second game back for the Canucks will not tell you as much as 1 week or a week and a half from now. And the one thing I hope, I hope they're healthy. But more than that, I just hope that there are not guys who get hurt from a lack of conditioning or having to play this accelerated schedule so that they can catch up to the rest of the North Division. Because they... You know, like the by the standings, Jeff, like they are still in the playoff picture. You know what I mean? If they rolled off, I mean, I don't expect it, but if they won five of their next six games in terms of what they have to make up in that division, they're very close to fourth. So this is not easy stuff for the league, but you just have to hope they did their due diligence and talk to the Canucks organization.
Ian McIntyre's Canucks beat reporter with Sportsnet. We'll take a deeper dive into the Canucks. This is Writer's Block. Joined by Tim Leeper, Dan Shulman, Brian Lawton on the show again. The Blue Jays are off today. They will start a two-game series in Boston tomorrow against the first-place Boston Red Sox, something we all saw coming. All right, we all thought that we would be staring at the American League standings on April 19th and that Boston would be leading the East and Kansas City would be leading the Central and Seattle would be leading the West. Right. The Vancouver Canucks beat the Toronto Maple Leafs last night. It was one of those, it was almost, the game was almost, it was almost literature, right? I mean, everything you like to assume about sports, you know, the team with its back against the wall coming out, the highly favored team, you know, doing everything but scoring, all that goalie standing in his head, all that good stuff. It was a work of literature. Now, the question is, and we'll bring Ian McIntyre, who covers the Canucks for Sportsnet, on. Ian, was that a nice chapter in what is otherwise going to be a depressing story? How did you view it?
It was a nice chapter, and it was great theater. As literature, I wish it could have written itself. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had to do it.
You undersell your talents, my friend.
Well, luckily, 4 o'clock start Vancouver time. People out here sometimes complain. I don't know if you've heard this. Sometimes people on the West Coast have, for some reason, some kind of resentment against Toronto. I don't know why. People complain about the 4 o'clock starts for Eastern media. I love it because I actually have time to write instead of a 45-minute turnaround. It was fabulous, you know, and on so many levels. But just the story itself of these guys who have been hollowed out by this terrible virus and contracted what appears to be a worse strain than anything the NHL had seen until that point. And this was on top of what had been a pretty miserable season for them so far. And to have a game like that where, you know, they're outshot by 2-1 through two periods, and had the Maple Leafs not overhandled the puck at times and tried to pass it into an empty net and sometimes missed an empty net, I mean, that could have been a 4 or 5 goal game. Braden Holtby was brilliant as well, which was another part of the story. But just for the Canucks to win that, it was, as the players said after, it was what they needed to now kind of launch them forward. With what they've been through, they couldn't have had a better start. But I don't know whether it's a one-game start or whether this is the start of something good for them. But it was a memorable night for sure, no matter what happens on Tuesday.
Ian, in the piece I read of yours today, you wrote that finishing the NHL season with nearly an entire roster of coronavirus survivors is a monumental challenge that seems almost impossible to conclude with any competitive success. That's interesting because it's literally what Jeff and I were just talking about before we brought you in. On the one hand, you know, knock on wood, we hope that these guys won't get injured because of the accelerated schedule, the amount of times that they're going to have to play to catch up. But beyond that, this is what I wanted to ask you. Like, what is the collective health of this group? And how could the collective health be anywhere close to 100% given what these guys have endured with a variant that we've all read is just even that much stronger than, you know, what regular COVID was?
Yeah, well, they're not. I think that's the simple answer or the simple conclusion. Of course, they're not sharing their medical charts with us. But they're not 100%. They can't be 100%. And the danger among so many with COVID is, as we've seen in society, there's the long-haul effects. And literally no team has, at least no major sports team in North America, has been knocked down by the P1 variant that originated in Brazil. And there's lots of data to show, and we saw firsthand here, that it's more voracious and possibly more harmful long term than what the regular strain is. So these guys aren't healthy. They're healthy enough to play, but they went into last night's game. There's still three players, including starting goalie Thatcher Demko, who had been their MVP this season. Three players too sick to play, plus two other players who were still technically on COVID protocol. And then you've got a whole bunch of guys who are at varying degrees of recovery, but obviously cleared to play and probably a lot stronger on Sunday than they would have been on Friday had their original return. But we just don't know how this is going to go. Because it hasn't been done. But it just looks, you know, you factor in their health, you factor in their schedule, you factor in that they weren't a good enough club in the first half of the season anyways, by any measure. And it's just hard to see how they're supposed to, I mean, they'll literally survive this, but it's hard to see how they're supposed to survive this competitively. You know, if you were taking bets, 19 games to play, now 18, but even give them the win as a head start, the over-under, you know, maybe 8 wins if things go well. So they're in a tough spot. But I'll say this, with the enthusiasm that they showed last night in that win and, you know, Holtby charging all the way down the ice like it's a playoff overtime goal to give Horvat a hug, their emotional energy right now is exceedingly high. And for the time being, because this first week they get to kind of ease back into it by only playing once every 2 days, that emotional energy will probably make up for whatever physical energy they'll lack at times. But this is an awfully long task here, you know, a whole month of this. So we'll see how it goes, but it was a great start.
What did you make of the play involving Edler?
Bad play. Bad hit. Dangerous hit. I don't think there was any malice to it, but at this point, that's kind of a secondary consideration. Alex Edler isn't a player who has ever tried to injure anybody when he has been suspended before. And there were two incidents, and you have to go back 8 and 9 years ago. They were sort of hockey play hits, and not one where he went out of his way to try to get somebody. It it's too bad. I'm sure if you asked Edler, I'm sure he would say it was a hit that he shouldn't have made and he wishes he hadn't. But it was kind of a perfect storm that went against Zach Hyman on that play, because the Canucks had been under siege. Edler had been on the ice for a full penalty kill. All the Canucks on the ice were desperate just to get off, just to find the sanctuary of the bench. And I think it was Antoine Roussel should have been able to get the puck deep as Edler was going towards the bench for a line change. He lost it to Hyman, turned it over. Hyman comes back the other way. Suddenly Edler's going the wrong direction at the end of a very long shift, and he made a split-second decision that was wrong. You know, he was going to get beaten by Hyman, and he veered into him. And that said, you know, this isn't for people who remember, say, Brian Marchment. This wasn't a guy extending his leg and knee outward to try to get somebody. But it was a subtle turn into him, into Hyman, and it injured Hyman. And I think there'll be a supplemental discipline consequence because of it.
You know, Ian, if we look at this from a Toronto-centric perspective, it was a game they gave away. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. They absolutely outplayed the Canucks. They beat them basically every kind of analytical stat you can get. And so it does bring up the question, and again, you're outside the city, so I think you're a good guy to ask this, is, you know, when you look at that Leafs team, what you saw, did you see last night as an aberration and maybe just a goaltender playing on his head? Or once again, is there something perhaps structurally wrong with this team, which ultimately will prevent them from where they hope to go, which is getting out of the North Division and into the semis?
Yeah, well, I think Toronto is a very good team. And I've the great thing about this season is we've all gotten to know the Canadian teams really well. And they're great rivals. It's too bad each game doesn't have 20,000 fans, because what a season it would have been then. And Toronto, I think, is the best team. But, you know, I said a few minutes ago that, you know, Toronto overpassing the puck and looking, you know, for an open net. And there is a lot of risk to their game. And I understand that the team has been far more well-rounded this season than previously, as far as the chances they're giving up and their attention to detail on their own half of the ice. But they still make a lot of risky plays with the puck. That's just the way they play. They got an incredibly high skill level, and they flex it. But they also give the puck away. And on the, I'm trying to think which goal it was, the first goal when it's 2-0, you know, Matthews turns the puck over in the offensive zone. And you know, at that point, he's trying to make an offensive play. He's 150 feet from his net. But it was still a turnover that went back the other way. And Horvat scored on a breakaway. And suddenly in a game where Vancouver could have been down by 4 or 5 goals, it's a one-goal game. And it was another turnover up ice in the neutral zone by Toronto that led to Vancouver's second goal. So, you know, my assessment of them is they are the best team in Canada, and they have an awful lot of talent. And when they're going, they're hard for anybody to contain defensively. But, you know, they have to show that they can win this way in the playoffs. And they haven't shown that they can win anyway in the playoffs lately. But, you know, I think probably they need to be a little tidier with the puck yet if they want to beat the really good teams from the U.S. if Toronto gets out of the Canadian division. And that's no guarantee, even though I say they're the best. Edmonton, with the maturation of McDavid and Dreisaitl and the evolution of Darnell Nurse and just better defense generally, and then the way Mike Smith is playing, Edmonton is going to be a really difficult out. And Winnipeg, at times, they look really stout. And, you know, their offensive firepower with Hellebuyck in goal is formidable. They don't have the defense that some other teams do. But it's not going to be easy for Toronto. They certainly have the skill level. But I think they need to probably clean up some things eventually if they want to advance.
Ian, really good of you to do this today. Thanks so much, my friend.
Stay safe. Being on with you guys. I'm glad I kept my old-fashioned home phone line so that there's no issue with cell coverage where I am today.
You are a smart man, Mr. McIntyre. Thanks for doing this, man. Take care.
All right. Have a good afternoon, guys.
You too. That's Ian McIntyre, the terrific Canucks beat reporter for Sportsnet. On a landline.
Old school.
Old school. Ian's an old school writer, too. I mean, that was some real old school beat writer logic there about how 4 o'clock is good because he got more time to write, et cetera, et cetera. Man after my own heart. Tim Leeper is a minor league outfield and base running coordinator with the San Francisco Giants. His day job is Sportsnet 590, the fan baseball analyst. And that is the role we are going to ask him to occupy right now. Tim Leeper's next. This is Writer's Block. All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. Dan Shulman. Brian Lawton will join us in the 4 o'clock hour. And there's no Blue Jays baseball tonight. The Blue Jays have tonight off. They will take on the Boston Red Sox in the first of two games starting tomorrow at Fenway Park. Hyunjin Ryu on the mound for the Blue Jays. Eduardo Rodriguez, who you may remember, suffered a heart condition that was linked to COVID-19. One of the first professional athletes, actually, to develop post-COVID symptoms. You know, I remember reading that story and talking about that story, Richard, when we were on air, and we looked at that as maybe the thin edge of the wedge. You know, Eduardo Rodriguez developing a heart issue that was linked to COVID-19. He will, in fact, pitch for the Red Sox tomorrow as they take on Hyunjin Ryu and the Toronto Blue Jays. The Blue Jays, losers of three of four against the Kansas City Royals on the weekend. Tim Leeper is a San Francisco Giants outfield and base running coordinator, and he joins us in Writer's Block. Hello, Mr. Leeper.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. Hey, Tim, if I told you, I don't know, 3 weeks ago that the Yankees would be in last in the East and that Boston, Kansas City, and Seattle would be leading the American League divisions, what would you have said to me that, you know, we can say over the airwaves here publicly?
What I normally say to you, that you are completely full of, you know what? But it's COVID, and that's what COVID does. It produces some strange results.
Yeah, it certainly has early in the year. Look, I want to talk to you about the Blue Jays in a minute and about the Dodgers as well. I mean, another great story here. But what's going on with the Yankees? You know, I understand the Rays have the Yankees number. Okay, that sometimes happens. But, you know, they've been getting everything you need from Gerrit Cole. It's still the same lineup that a lot of people were raving about in spring training. Yet not only were they swept by the Rays, but I mean, they didn't show much fight to the point where Aaron Boone had to have a closed door meeting to read them the riot act. I mean, this team and the Rays, they've been going at it for the past year. They've been throwing at each other. They've been emptying the dugouts. Kevin Cash basically threatened nuclear war against the Yankees last year. And Leap, the Yankees looked like they just wanted no part of the Rays.
It's an interesting scenario because the Yankees have really changed a lot. And, you know, we talk about they're not really the Yankees anymore. They've really gone to, like, a different style of how they run their game, how they teach their hitting, what they're doing with their catchers and all those things. And they had the big closed-door meeting last year when Cashman went to Buffalo. And it's not really great when you have to have a closed door meeting like right after spring training and then those kind of things happen. I'm just wondering if they're doing too much and it's really different than the way they've ever done things and it's starting to catch up with them a little bit. And one thing I think with the offense is kind of go with the Blue Jays. Like, we're about 40, 60 at bats in for guys and things can change really, really quickly. And when you don't hit, it just looks like your team is really bad. But it seems like, you know, you never heard before the Yankees having these meetings and things like this. And you just kind of wonder if the edge and the glow's coming off them just a little bit. The Rays are like a thorn in everybody's side. And it seems, I mean, they've always had our number or Toronto's number for sure. And now they're definitely getting the Yankees. So it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting dynamics in baseball just with the injuries. And especially in the American League East with the Rays, you know, they're just quietly becoming a thorn in everybody's side.
You know, Tim, I'll just follow up on this one, and Jeff will eventually get to the Dodgers. I mean, is it possible that the division is just not as good as we might have thought it was? And I say that because there's always, and rightfully so, this understanding that the Yankees are going to be good and that their lineup's going to be loaded and, you know, they'll figure out a way to get starters, and the Rays obviously always sort of over-exceed everyone's expectations. But I got to give Blair credit because he was on this from the beginning. Like, that Yankees team, particularly their pitching, is not very good once you get past Gerrit Cole. And so I just wonder, and again, I expect them to hit because, you know, there's too many good hitters in that lineup. But, you know, I mean, maybe the sort of the thought prior to the season is you gave the Yankees more of the benefit of the doubt, literally because of what the brand has always been.
And it always, I think you're always going to do that. But we've said that. I don't know how many years that I was there that we said the same thing. Well, they're not very good this year. And in 15, they really weren't very good. But gosh, you had to fight tooth and nail for every win that you ever got against them. And I think they always have a way just professionally, like, to kind of get things done. But I also think you're right with the pitching. There's really four unknowns after Cole. I mean, there's a lot of hope and not a lot of guys with a huge track record, and there's been guys with injuries. I think they'll find a way. And I was looking at stuff today because I looking at the offenses and things, and I kind of go back to our team in 2016. Like in 2015, obviously we went 43-18 down the stretch. We were the best offensive team in baseball. There's no doubt. But I go into 2016. And after 23 games, like, we were the worst team in baseball with, like, the worst offense in baseball. And I think you see a lot of that earlier. And I think the Yankees on the offensive side of it right now, it is kind of similar to that. I mean, it's kind of a little bit the same with the Jays. So I think they find a way to come out of it. I think, you know, not having Zach Britton down the pen, I think that's a huge loss for him. I think the way they deployed the relievers, too, you know, like Chad Green used to be just, like, a really shutdown guy, you know, in the seventh, eighth inning. Now they put them out in the fifth sometimes. I just think they've thrown the balance off there a little bit. They're trying to find their way. And I think the more they get back to basics with the Yankees, I think the better off they're going to be. The mystique works for them. And I think they need to play that to their advantage as opposed to looking like they're in a panic mode. And that's kind of what they seem like right now.
So, Tim, I did want to ask you about the Dodgers after that series against the San Diego Padres. The Dodgers are 13-3. Look, I said at the start of the year, I thought they might set a record for most wins in the regular season. I don't know if I really believe that. Every now and then I am given to hyperbole, but I'm beginning to think I'm beginning to think I might be right. Like, you know, we had Barker in Baseball Central said, well, the real test will be when they have a huge lead going into September and they're resting guys for the playoffs. And my point was, yeah, but Bark, they're second best player at every position. You know, it's probably good enough to put together a pretty good major league team at this point in time. I have to ask you, Tim, could they be the best team? Could they be the best team we've seen in 20 years by the time this thing is done?
They're really deep. And, you know, the Padres aren't far behind them. You know, just a couple plays in that series changes a lot of games. But they are. They're really good. And you're right. Their bench players would be hitting the middle of the lineup for a lot of teams. And I think back to, like, who the last best team was that liked that. And it had to be that Mariners team. I don't think that was the last. How many did they win? They won 117 games, but yeah. Was that more than 20 years ago, or am I aging myself?
No, I think you're around there.
Yeah, so, and then you know what happened to them in the playoffs. I think once you get to the playoffs, like, all bets are off. Like, you could run into a bad matchup really quick. And I worry about teams that coast into the postseason because they're not challenged enough. And then when they get that first challenge, they're just not ready for it. And the Dodgers could be that team, but I think those guys have been through this enough, and I think they're going to get enough competition from the Padres this year to where that probably won't happen to them. But, like, if you're looking at teams that are really deep and that are really good, like, the Dodgers are definitely there. And I don't know if you got a chance. You know, it's great being on the West Coast because now you actually get to follow West Coast baseball a little bit more. But that Dodger-Padres series was a great baseball series. And I'm watching a lot of games right now that are not really fun to watch. And that was high level pitching, hitting, you know, all the other little things that go into it. Like, that was a great baseball series. And that's everything that's good about the game right now. And I can't say that about every other games that we're watching. But that was like a September baseball series, like real early in the season. And that's going to be a fun battle to watch as the season progresses.
Yeah, it really was. There was, I think the word I'm looking for, there was an edginess. There was an edginess to it, you know. And we saw it. We've seen it a couple. It's odd. We've seen it early this year in a couple of games. You know, we've seen the Indians and the White Sox. There was some edge to that series. The Yankees and the Rays. You know, last week there was a little bit of an edge to that series. That's why I was so surprised that we really didn't see much this weekend from the Yankees. But it does seem as if, I mean, you're right. I've seen a lot of bad baseball so far this year, Leap, but I've also seen a lot more edginess than I thought I've seen. I don't know if guys are just kind of pissed off more than usual, or maybe they sense that the divisions are up for grabs, but there's a little more nastiness than we normally see early in the year.
Yeah, so you got the Cardinals and the Reds getting a little tiff that one time too. And I like it. I mean, it's good. I think it's everything good about baseball. And I really like that. But when you look at those two teams and you look at the characters in each team, and there's some really, really big personalities on the Padres and obviously the Dodgers, you know, they got the World Series championship now, but they got some really edgy personalities in there. Like, those are great. Those are like old Red Sox Yankee matchups, you know?
Mm-hmm. Tim, thanks for doing this, man. Stay safe. Be well.
All right. Same to you guys. Great talking to you as always.
Take care. That's Tim Leeper. He's the minor league outfield and base running coordinator with the San Francisco Giants. And it's kind of fun. Look, Deitch, baseball, I've always thought baseball is more fun when you're talking about the Yankees. It's great when the Yankees are really good and everybody's aiming for them. And it's also kind of neat when they're in crisis, especially early season. And I know as someone from that area, you know that the back pages right now, they're loving the fact that the Mets are on a bit of a roll and the Yankees aren't. Love it.
Every single major sports league needs a polarizing team, needs a team that people love or people love to hate. It's what drives pretty much every sport. We're talking at least every major sport, as well as American colleges. And so I'm with you. The Yankees either have to be really, really good or in some kind of, you know, Steinbrenner-like crisis mode. But that's good for the league. That's good for the sport. What would be bad for baseball, honestly, is if the Yankees are like 81-81. But right now, I think they're one of the interesting teams in the league because they're struggling.
Dan Shulman is our Blue Jays and MLB play-by-play voice on Sportsnet, 590 The Fan and Sportsnet. He joins us next. All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. It is a Monday. It is an off day for the Blue Jays and the Maple Leafs. And it's been quite a weekend in Toronto, to say the least. Including the Leafs losing to the COVID-ridden Vancouver Canucks. The Raptors putting together maybe the most badly timed winning streak in franchise history. I can't believe I'm saying that was true. And of course, the Blue Jays losing 3 of 4 games to the Kansas City Royals. And as both Barker and myself and Richard and myself and Tim Leeper noted, here we are looking at an American League standings that has the Yankees leading the East, the Royals leading the Central, and the Mariners leading the West. Dan Shulman, just as you were so boldly predicting at the start of the year.
What was I so boldly predicting at the start of the year?
That the Red Sox would be leading the East, that the Royals would be leading
the Central.
And that the Mariners would be leading the West, just as you predicted.
Of course. that was the easiest prediction in the world. But you know, it's time for the annual cautionary reminder. We're 10% of the way through the season right now. So if this were the NFL, we'd kind of be at halftime in week two. So. Mm-hmm. Lots of teams start 10-5 and lose 89 games. Lots of teams start 5-10 and win 94 games. But it's a little too early to draw trends, I think. But, hey, if it were a 60-game season, you know, and you're 15, 16 games in, that's a different story. But we're back to 162 now, so we got a ways to go.
What's a more real record to you, the Yankees 5-10 or the Red Sox 11-4?
I don't think either of them are real. I mean, you know, 5-10 would mean 54-108, and that ain't happening. And 11-4 would be like 120 wins or something like for the Red Sox. So I will say this. I thought before the year the Red Sox, like the notion that they would be terrible again, I didn't buy that. I kind of thought they had the look of a 500 team. You know, you remember, Jeff, last year the pitching staffs they were throwing out there against the Blue Jays. Like, they had nobody. Their staff was decimated by injuries. Plus, J.D. Martinez had a bad year. Rafael Devers had a bad year. Like, all their mainstays didn't have their normal years. I think they're a 500 team. I have kind of – the more I watch the Yankees, though, the more I think they're maybe not as good as we all thought they were going to be at the beginning of the season. Like, they're not 5-10, you know, 54-108 bad, but – you know, they're heavily dependent on Corey Kluber, Jameson Taillon to be good. And then you look at their lineup, like Stanton's not hitting, Hicks is not hitting, Torres isn't hitting. These are their guys. And I think they're maybe at risk of – I thought they were the best team in the division. I'm not so sure anymore. I think it could be one heck of a 3- or 4-team race in the American League East.
Dan, I'm one who believes that when George Springer – and Teoscar Hernandez return to the lineup, the team will hit. That will be the reason. And part of my thought is that it moves guys down the lineup, I think, to be in a position for better pitches. I think Marcus Semien's a perfect example of that. I think it takes some pressure off Bo and Vladdy. So I'm at least in terms of the bats, I'm buying that two significant pieces like that being out changes the complexion of the lineup. Where do you stand with that?
I agree to a certain extent. I look at it a little bit differently. Like, if you look at the 9 or the 10 guys the Blue Jays have, how many of them can we say with certainty, I know what this guy is as a hitter? I can with some degree of certainty predict what this guy is going to do this year. I think George Springer's in that category. He's done it enough. And I think Randall Grichuk's in that category. You know, Randall's been Randall for several years. But, Richard, when I look at it, like, Luis Gurriel doesn't look very good. And Teoscar Hernandez didn't look very good before he got COVID. And I understand it's small sample size. But I guess my point is, in Hernandez and Gurriel and even Bo and Kevin Biggio and Danny Jansen and a lot of these guys, I'm not sure we really know exactly what they are yet, because a lot of these guys have had one 60-game season and then maybe part of 2019 in the majors, and I think they're still evolving and they're still developing into ultimately the player that they will become. And I'll even throw Semien in there, because he had this extraordinary 2019, but every other year has been much different than that. So you listen, it's going to help, and I agree with you. Putting Springer up at the top is going to give the team a different look and a different energy, and it's definitely going to take some pressure off people. But I think for this team to score a lot of runs, like, they need Teoscar Hernandez to be good and they need Lourdes Gurriel to be good. Those two guys have to hit, and I'm hoping that they do. I'm hoping they look like the guys that they were last year, and if that's the case, this should be, you know, a top 3 or 4 offense in the American League.
Dan, are you buying what we've seen from Steven Matz?
Yes, that I am. And you know, we saw it all through the spring. You know, if I'd never heard of this guy and I didn't know where he pitched, what his name was or what his numbers were last year, you know, and Jeff, you've watched baseball as long as I have. Like, if you just watched the number 22 pitch, you would say, boy, that number 22's got good stuff. Like, he's got really good stuff. You know, he throws 96 from the left side. He's got a great changeup, and he's got a good curveball and a good slider that he mixes in there as well. And his command has been great. So like, again, he's 3-0, 147, or whatever he is. He's not going to be 32-0, 147. But, yes, I am buying the fact that he's going to be a productive pitcher for the Blue Jays, that this is, you know, this is not crazy what he's doing. And what they have unlocked, whether it was change of scenery or mechanics or I don't know. But, yeah, I am buying that he is going to be a productive, viable good starting pitcher for the Blue Jays. And boy, do they need him, right, with all the injuries on the staff. I mean, they desperately need a guy that they can know is the number two behind Hyunjin Ryu.
Dan, what, at least for this week, what do you think happens in the near term regarding what they're going to do for end-of-game situations?
That's a great question. So if they have a lead tomorrow night, I would imagine it's Rafael Dolis, unless it's a spot where Ryan Barucki or Tim Mazza makes sense. You know, if Devers is a key, you know, lefty is up and in a key spot, then I think it could be Barucki or Mazza. And then the next option I would think would be David Phelps, who doesn't have, you know, he doesn't profile as a closer. He doesn't throw 97. He's, you know, he's been kind of a middle guy. But I think because he's a veteran guy, low heart rate, they trust him a lot. They would use him in that spot as well. But it really is incredible. They're leading the American League in ERA, which is astounding, given everything that's gone on. But there's nothing that's more discouraging to a team than letting games get away late. And I hope they get some guys back soon. Pete Walker said Jordan Romano's situation looks minor, and hopefully he'll be back soon. I think he's eligible, I believe, Saturday or Sunday, something like that. So hopefully he's back, but you never know. I mean, he's been hurt a couple of times now, and you hope you keep him healthy. But isn't it amazing with Yates never even pitching and Romano being out and Merriweather being out, Phelps getting hit in the back by a line drive, Chatwood on the injured list, it's crazy. But they're kind of walking a fine line right now. They really are, and they can't afford to, you know, get too far below 500. So, you know, it would be nice, getting back to your question, Richard, about the offense, be nice to win some games by a big enough margin where you don't really have to worry about the ninth inning every now and again and just throw anybody out there to get three outs. But I still think Dolis is probably the number one option.
You know, Dan, there was a stat I stumbled across early in the telecast yesterday. And, you know, it's like a lot of baseball stats. It can mean it can be a double-edged sword. But it was the number of double plays turned. Mm-hmm. And the Blue Jays led the majors going into that game in the number of double plays turned. Tampa Bay was just behind them. Now, of course, my first reaction is, Jesus, got to be a lot of base runners on if you're going to have all those double plays. But that aside, you know, we talk about this team's infield defense and Biggio and Bichette and Semien and, of course, the guy at first base. Vladdy at first base. Has this infield defense been better than you thought it would be?
Well, let me go back to the first part, which was the number of double plays. We had a graphic during yesterday's game, and I forget the exact number, but I believe it was their ground ball percentage last year was 20th in baseball, and coming into the game yesterday, it was 4th in baseball. So that's a big part of it, too. Yep. They're getting guys to hit the ball on the ground. Part of it is Ryu. Part of it is Mats. There are a bunch of different guys. Some of it is new guys, and some of it is existing guys getting more contact on the ground. So that's part of it. Has the infield defense been better than I thought?
Yeah, or has it been worse or kind of the same?
Well, Vladdy's been better than I thought because you didn't know what you were going to see until you saw it. And I think he's been, by and large, really good over there. You know, early on, maybe stretched too far once instead of coming off the bag, maybe stretched too early once instead of reading the throw. But by and large, he's been really good. Semien's been very solid at second base. I think Bo has been Bo at short, and it remains to be seen whether he's the long-term shortstop or whether they feel they need to move him somewhere else. And I think Biggio's had some good games, but at times, and listen, his last game was the most glaring example, he didn't look very comfortable. And to me, he doesn't look all that comfortable over there. I think he's more comfortable at second. He's played a lot more second than third. He's only played 50 or 60 games in his life, minors and majors combined, at third base. So overall, I think it's been okay. You'd like to get it to better than okay. I don't know if they can do that this year. It might take them a year and some personnel changes to figure that out. Their infield defense, and listen, if this team is okay defensively, that's a big step forward from last year. Like they weren't even within shouting distance of okay defensively last year by any metric or the eye test. They were one of the two or three worst defensive teams in baseball last year. So even if they can get up into the middle of the pack, that's an improvement.
Dan, what are you hearing about Nate Pearson in terms of throwing schedule and, you know, knock on wood, a potential return?
So Pete Walker, usually Pete does the Sunday Zoom. Charlie does Monday through Saturday. Pete does Sunday. And unfortunately for Pete, first of all, he's willing to give us everything we need. And there's so many pitchers injured. Like, he's on there for like 25 minutes most of the time answering all these questions. So the first question to Pete yesterday actually was about Nate Pearson. So if I'm remembering correctly, he is going to throw tomorrow at Fenway Park. And I think Pete said, like, an up and down. I think it's kind of like a two-inning simulated thing. It might just be in the bullpen. I don't know if it's the live hitters. But it's a step. It's a step in the right direction. They're not going to rush him back. He's too valuable, obviously. And the other thing is, because he only pitched whatever he pitched, 20, 25 innings, whatever it was, last year, I think they're not rushing him back, too, because if you rush him back, you can only throw him so many innings this year. Then you'd have to shut him down. So why not ease him back into it, you know, be 100% sure, if that's possible, that he's healthy, and then have him for the rest of the season. So I think they're going to go slowly, Richard. I don't think he's back for at least 3 weeks. The second question to Pete about Pearson was, in your mind, Pete, does he have to be built up into a starter before he rejoins the team? Or could you bring him back in a shorter role? And Pete said that'll depend on how he responds once they ramp him up and the needs of the team. And I don't think it's crazy. And, Jeff, I think you and I talked about this a few weeks ago. Remember, I jumped off of Zoom and right on with you, and I think this was what we were talking about that day. I don't think it's crazy to make him a tandem or a piggyback guy. And whether he starts or is the second guy, to me, doesn't matter all that much. But what if you had Anthony Kay and Nate Pearson paired up three innings? Or if Robbie Ray, I mean, you want Robbie Ray to be a legit starter and get deep into the game. But what if you pair up Robbie Ray, Nate Pearson? I don't think it's crazy to have Nate Pearson come back and throw two innings, building up to three innings and maybe building up beyond there. And just let him get comfortable, get some outs, stay healthy, and then see where he is at the end of the season. So I'm sorry for the long answer to your short question, Richard, but I think it's going to be a while, and I don't think we have 100% certainty as to what kind of role he'll have when he comes back.
Yeah, I'm with you completely, Dan. I think, you know, I look at what Texas is doing, but also what the Jays did, pardon me, with Aaron Sanchez. And, you know, the idea is get the guy in a regular routine. Try to get, I do get what Pete is saying. They want to build him up as a starter. But what does that mean? Does that mean he's capable of giving you four innings, five and two-thirds innings? Well, okay, put him on a routine where you can expect that from him. But put him with Anthony Kay. And I don't know, maybe in a lineup against a lot of left-handed hitters, you let Anthony Kay go two innings, then you bring him in for four. Or vice versa. Tough right-handed lineup, him for four, Kay for two. Because you're going to have to manage both of those guys. You're going to have to manage their innings somehow. And to me, it just makes sense that you pair those two up. And you also create issues for the opposing manager, and you might as well do that. If you're going to do something that's going to put a wrinkle in, you might as well do it.
Yeah, and this is the year of the wrinkle, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it is. Going from 60 games to 162, the Blue Jays have been carrying only a three-man bench, which is one less than a lot of teams. So they've got 14 pitchers. A lot of teams have 13. That might afford you the opportunity to have tandems or piggybacks for, if not the entire season, part of the season. But whatever, you write everything in pencil this year, because whatever's being done now could change in 2 weeks. Like, you know, 2 weeks ago, the big question was, what do you mean Anthony Kay? Why is Anthony Kay not on the team? And he's down getting, you know, he's doing his throwing, but this guy's ahead of him, and this guy's ahead of him, and this guy's ahead of him. Like right now, Anthony Kay, in my mind, is their fourth starter. But that would change. I think he's going to start on Wednesday, or at least have a big part of the game on Wednesday. But that could all change next week, depending on who they're facing. Things are going to be in a constant state of flux. And I think it would be great for Pearson. I know he wants to be a starter, but I know everybody wants him to be a starter because that's where the value is. But if he could come back and pitch 2-3 innings and hopefully blow people away like he did against Tampa in the playoff game when he was, you know, overpowering for a couple of innings, and just build up his confidence, build up his stamina, make sure he can stay healthy, then I think it could pay dividends later in the season. But it's going to be, you know, the roster moves are going to be unbelievable. And there's no such thing as, hey, we can pencil in these five guys to start for the next several weeks. That's just not the way it's going to work anymore.
You know, Dan, I'm intrigued. I understand there are going to be a lot of roster moves made this year. But when I look at the Jays bench right now, and I look at Jonathan Davis and Josh Palacios, look, Teoscar and George Springer are going to be back. That's going to leave you with four outfielders if you don't move Davis or Palacios. Probably one of them has to go. Anyway, Palacios' left-handed bat keeps him here.
I think it might keep him here when the first of Springer or Teoscar comes back.
Mm-hmm.
But when the second one comes back, I have trouble seeing a spot because, like you said, they have four outfielders with Grichuk and Gurriel. So, and this gets back to if you're only going to carry a three-man bench, you obviously need two catchers. So one of the catchers is on your bench. You need an infielder. That's Joe Panik. And then you've kind of got an extra guy, whether it's the fourth outfielder or Rowdy Tellez, because Vladdy's at first, who's DHing. So I have trouble seeing room for Davis or Palacios once Springer and Teoscar come back. Maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like a logjam. And I think that ninth reliever, unfortunately for Jonathan Davis and Josh Palacios, mm-hmm. I think the ninth reliever is, as crazy as it sounds, is more important than that extra guy off the bench. I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to see one or both of these guys get an opportunity. But I think once the other two guys that I mentioned come back, I have trouble seeing either one of them on the team.
Dan, really good of you to do this, man, as always. Thanks so much.
Hey, happy to give the landline some work today.
Yes, sir.
That was good.
There's a whole bunch of people rediscovering, you know, the virtues of landlines. I love it. I'm waiting for somebody to call up with a dial phone, a rotary phone.
It should be a theme. Like we could sell Landline Monday or something. Like they should brand this and make some money off it or something.
There's got to be a way of making money off it. It is the year where you it's the year where you take something that isn't good and try to turn it into something good. That's
right.
Sponsored by Braniff Airlines, which I think went out of business in 1979.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Okay, guys. Be well.
Dan Shulman, voice of the Blue Jays on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. Brian Lawton is an analyst with the NHL Network. So I don't know. I still haven't figured out. Should I be really upset that the Leafs lost to the franchise formerly known as the Vancouver Canucks last night? Or should I just take solace? Should I just take solace in the story? Should I cheer for the story, the grittiness and the all that good stuff? I'm conflicted here because I'm sure there are folks out there who'd love me to unload, with the flamethrower, right? And hammer the Leafs. But somehow, some reason, I don't feel like I can do it. We'll see if Brian Lawton can get me motivated to do it next. This is Writer's Block. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, we can tell you that Alex Edler of the Vancouver Canucks has been suspended two games by the National Hockey League for kneeing Toronto Maple Leafs forward Zach Hyman last night. No indication yet, I don't believe anyhow, from the Leafs as to the extent of the injury to Hyman, although Zach Hyman's value to this this organization has been, well, it's been well documented over the past couple of years. And if anything, Zach Hyman's value to the Leafs seems to have even increased this year. So again, we are awaiting further word from Zach Hyman and from the Leafs, I should say, about Zach Hyman's situation. But early indications were that the biggest concern is the fact that the knee that Edler hit, which is his right knee, was the one that required ACL surgery and some recovery in 2019. So we will wait to see if there's any further information on Zach Hyman, who, as I mentioned, has been a very important part of this team. I also mentioned before the break that I didn't know how to look at last night's game. It's kind of tricky with the Leafs right now, because I think most of us look at the Leafs and think they're still the best team in the Canadian division. You know, most of us look at what the Vancouver Canucks did last night, and in particular Braden Holtby. I think you'd have to be a remarkably callous individual to not sort of at least have some sort of admiration for the fact that the Canucks were able to pull out that win. You know, despite the fact that they've been ravaged by COVID-19, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with cheering for the story, but I'm beginning to wonder right now a little bit about the Toronto Maple Leafs. I guess I wouldn't mind seeing the Leafs do a little better job putting teams away. Now, maybe I'm asking too much. Maybe this is just, you know, in effect, kind of the dog days of this particular NHL season. Brian Lawton is an analyst with the NHL Network, and he joins us on Writer's Block. So, Brian, what do you make out of what we've seen of the Leafs so far? Is this just kind of a blip, a glitch, you know, a bump in the road? Or the fact that this team, one, has had trouble killing teams off, and two, seems life and death to be able to make anything work in the power play. Would those concern you? Are those underlying reasons for pretty serious concern here?
No, I don't have a ton of pretty serious concerns about the Leafs personally. I think they've had an amazing season. I think they've had incredible growth, you know, individual players throughout the team. They've been able to bring together a cast of, you know, quite a few new players as well and integrate them into the locker room. That's never easy. They're going to try to do that, obviously, with Nick Foligno. I don't think that's going to be difficult with his character and with the people the Leafs have in the room now. So, no, everybody, you know, you can look at the best teams in the league, and they've all gone through a stretch where they look maybe just a little bit lackluster. I can't find any reasons why in the strangest of years I would think that Toronto should be or would be different. I think they're in the top five or six teams in the league, personally. And I think that there's a lot of picking lint off a $1,000 suit up there in Toronto when you guys look at the Leafs.
I love that.
I'll take that $1,000 suit, Brian. Thank you. You had a long playing career, and then obviously you had a managerial career. So you've been in the locker room as a player. You've been in locker rooms as a personnel head. Can you give us a sense of, like, how much of an impact can Nick Foligno make? He's obviously a talented player. He'll come in and he'll fit into, I mean, I guess depending on the Zach Hyman injury, we'll sort of see where he fits in. But can you just give our audience a sense of, like, realistically, how much can one player coming in April make on sort of whatever the chemistry or the culture is of a group?
I do think it's significant. I had a little bit of history with this as a manager. You know, we drafted Victor Hedman, and I signed Matthias Olin, who everybody will remember from the Vancouver Canucks, who was a little bit past his prime, not unlike Nick is, at least in terms of offensively. I think Nick still has a lot in the tank, and even more so. But it's so valuable to just the Leafs are a really unique dynamic now. They've got all these incredible, great young players. And the last piece in their development is to show them or teach them how to win. And I think they've done an awesome job. I think a lot of the players that have been brought in, it's not so much the impact that they have on the scoreboard. And I think Kyle Dubas is really smart for this and his whole department, to be honest with you. It's moving the meter with the intangibles. And for a team that is supposed to be an analytics team, the Toronto Maple Leafs, I think that's really smart of them to recognize that that component does matter as well. And for that, you know, I think Nick Foligno is a perfect fit for them. I think the price they paid is what the price is. Everybody's kind of changed their views on that. And you're seeing people that are almost kind of engineering their team for a certain series, maybe somebody they're worried about. Teams have been doing it this year with their taxi squads more than I've ever seen. You see kind of a reworking of lineups on a lot of teams, not so much the Leafs, to be fair, but a lot of teams that have a lot of similar players. So I think Nick will have a bigger impact that fans won't notice as much as on the scoreboard.
You know, Kelly Rudy made a point on during Hockey Night in Canada that I found interesting. And there's a little background here. We had Curtis Joseph in studio a couple of years ago, and it was for a foundation, the Curtis Joseph Foundation or something. And one of the points he made, Brian, when we were talking is, let's be blunt here. Curtis was not one of the most colorful interviews in the history of the NHL. And his point was, you know, part of the reason, you know, he said, I frankly never really said much of anything is because I didn't want to let, you know, I didn't want to let people know that I was lacking confidence or that I was worried about my game, lost a couple of games in the row. I wasn't going to go in front of the media and go, boy, I got to get my act together, got to work harder, yada, yada. You know, I wanted to sort of exude confidence and hopefully that would get through to the teammates. And Kelly's point about Jack Campbell was, we've heard a lot from Jack Campbell since he's been here, and we've heard a lot of, well, I need to be better, games that they've won. I can't make a mistake like that. Those are both after games that they've won. You know, I need to be sharper. The team, I need to give more to my teammates. That loss is on me. In a locker room, you know, what do you want in from a goalie in terms of accountability?
You'd always love your goalie. Very few times have I seen the goalie be an alpha male personality in terms of the total group. I've seen lots that had that personality for themselves and in their role, but not for the group. One guy comes to mind, Sean Burke. I always loved Berkey because he would stand up and when he was in Arizona and he might grab Tkachuk and Roenick by the jersey and say, straighten up. He had a lot of accountability, not only for himself, but for the group. I don't look at it for the group. I find that more of an anomaly that you're going to get that type of leadership. And maybe Luongo had that to some degree, but probably not in as menacing a way that Berkey could do it. For Jack, I think he's done a great job. I really do. He's very well liked. You cannot underestimate how important it is for a goaltender to be liked by his group. There's been many that haven't, that had success. But, boy, the world is a lot better when the team likes your goalie. And when they like both goalies, it's fantastic. Jack came in as that backup, I think, earned that respect. He's obviously had to step into a more prominent role now. And he's just continued to be the same guy. And I think that bodes well for him. And yet, you know, you bring in guys like Foligno and Joe Thornton and Wayne Simmons and Jason Spezza, guys that have been around, and you're hopeful that those guys can lend some guidance in the room when things go sideways, particularly when they go really bad. And I do think that you don't know what's going on in there, fellas. I will tell you that. Even as a GM, I was always, you know, probing and crying with the coaches, you know, tell me about the room. Tell me who's the leader. Tell me, you know, what's happening here, how they react here. You want to know that stuff badly. I was never one of those guys to have cameras everywhere. There have been a few GMs that tend to actually physically see and listen to everything. I didn't want to be that as an ex-player because I always felt insulted by that. But I can tell you, you're always craving. The less leadership you have, the more you're craving to know what's going on behind closed doors.
You know, Brian, there's a very good likelihood that if Freddie Anderson's health gets back to what it is, I'm sure some of it for him Also, there's a confidence element here. But Kyle Dubas, Brendan Shanahan, Sheldon Keefe have they may have essentially the choice of the year coming when it's a week and a half before the playoffs start as to who gets designated the number one goalie. And what makes it very tricky is that if Jack Campbell is, you know, let's say good, very good one night, not as good the next night, that makes it a very, very hard decision because, you know, Freddie has been your number one, but the playoffs have sort of been the issue. And then you have Jack Campbell, who when he's great has been great, but has never been a starting goaltender in the playoffs. Strikes me that, you know, the year could be determined by if they guess right on that.
I think it's true. I think it'll be really tough on him if it happens in the timeline that you're saying. If it happens beyond that, then I don't think it's as tough. If it happens earlier, I think they'll have enough time to work through it. But I don't know what the stand will be from Sheldon Keefe. Obviously having it played, I was always friends with a lot of the goaltenders. I ended up working with Mike Liu. We were such good friends. But I'm always curious, you know, what coaches tell the goalies. You know, some of them tell you, well, you got injured, so you got to come back and earn your job. Other guys say you can't lose your job getting injured. That will be the decision that has to be made. Did Freddie Anderson lose his job because he was injured, or no, he automatically gets his job back? And I think that that'll be handled very delicately. And ultimately, it's an arbitrary decision. You know, it wasn't that long ago that Philip Grubauer started the playoffs for the Washington Capitals, and Brayton Holpe was the guy standing there at the end of the playoff run. He played the first two games that year against Pittsburgh, I believe Grubauer did. And then Holpe came in and took it the rest of the way. Holpe was the clear starter, but really fumbled down the stretch. And you had a little flip-flop of positions, but it didn't take long to rectify. So it's a crapshoot. It really is. But those are tough decisions and ones you've got to give a lot of consideration to.
Brian, how surprised are you that we are – I understand this may be an unfair question, but how surprised are you that we are seeing the Vancouver Canucks, that they're going to attempt to try to play this thing, you know, play this thing out here after COVID-19? Like, I understand – someone said to me, this idea that you wait a little longer, it's not going to make any difference. Either you make a call, either you shut it down, or you start the season up again, because 5 days is just going to increase the rust. It's not necessarily going to make guys better. I mean, they got to get in game shape. It's not just about rest, et cetera, et cetera. What's your level of concern about how this is being approached?
We had JT Miller on. Interviewed him this week, and he was pretty candid. You know, it's a lot of emotion. It was kind of talked about up front. You know, players, you know, one thing that everybody should recognize is that players did want to play this year, and rightly so. They recognize, you know, it kind of got turned into a little bit, it sounded a little bit like now they were almost being made to play, and that just wasn't true. That was false. If JT wanted to opt out or any other player, they still could. So ultimately, I commend them. But in looking at the totality of it, this was something that was certainly discussed as a possibility. I think the NHL has been pretty lucky overall with how things have gone. They've missed games, and games have been postponed. It's been disruptive. A team like the Dallas Stars has been beat over the head. A team like the New Jersey Devils probably didn't get as much, you know, airtime as you might think. It was interesting. I spoke to one of the parents that has players on both teams, so you could figure that out. And early on, they thought that New Jersey had a rougher ride than right. Vancouver. But then Vancouver kind of, you know, it didn't end and it dragged on. So I just think it's really unfortunate. You know, when Vancouver won, I don't know how anybody, even in Toronto, couldn't have been pulling for those players.
Yeah.
I know the Leaf fans want to win every night, but it's literally, this happened to me once in my career. Unfortunately, someone had lost a relative. I'll just say that because I don't want to say who. And I was down in Tampa, and they beat us. And I called them after the game, and I said, hey, you know what? I just want to say I'm so happy you guys won tonight. And I don't know how people couldn't have those feelings for Vancouver. It has been traumatic for them. It's one game. It's one win. It is definitely the time when you want to be classy about that stuff and a gentleman. So, you know, it was a really impressive effort by Vancouver. Let's just say that.
Brian, really good of you to do this as always. Thanks so much. Stay safe and be well.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lawton of the NHL Network. And that really is well said. I mean, you know, all kidding or whatever aside, I'm hoping that there are enough results like last night for the Vancouver Canucks and their players and their families to make this a little more palatable. I think, Richard, I'm safe in saying that.
I think there has to be
some sort of, I don't know if reward is the right word. There has to be some sort of satisfaction that can be earned beyond simply the paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, without having talked to those guys, I think they're very thankful to be doing something, Jeff, that they love to do again after having, at least in this country, what's the worst kind of COVID given the variant. The other thing, too, is, and I really appreciate this from the Canucks players, a couple of them were very honest, Jeff, about the impact on their family.
Yep.
And how worried they were. That's really, I mean, you may not think that matters, but like, I think that matters when it comes to like putting COVID into like ways that people can understand, maybe convincing somebody to get vaccinated. Like when you see major players in the country's biggest sport talking about like, you know, how scared they were about like their wife or son or child getting it. Like that's important stuff. And I give them a lot of credit. They, you know, people have been very circumspect about COVID, including, and we've seen it in this city with Austin Matthews. And I'm not saying he owes anybody a large explanation of what it was like and how he felt, but I do think it's worth us saying thank you very much for being forthright and honest on this stuff, because I think it matters when people of celebrity do it.
Well, and you know, I'll say this as well. Look, anecdotally, there are people who get COVID-19 and have very few symptoms.
Correct. Especially young athletes
Exactly. You know, I know there are people out there saying, come on, Jeff, look at the COVID list in Major League Baseball at the start of last year. You know, five. So look at the Marlins. How come all those Marlins players came back and played and everything? Well, it's important to realize that you know, not everybody is going to be forced to bed rest for 2 weeks with this stuff.
Correct.
But there are people who are, well, you know, look at David Sampson. There are people who get really sick when they have this.
Jalen Brown is still using an inhaler.
And I'm with you.
That's an NBA All-Star.
I think it's important that those, it's not that you scare people into doing something, but I think it's important that the reality of COVID-19 is presented to people exactly as often as possible. And yes, some people are asymptomatic. Some people, it's a common cold. Some people get a headache. Other people die or almost die. That's just the way it is. And if you have enough people of profile or athletes presenting that possibility to people, you know, the possibility or the idea that, yeah, I was really sick. I'm with you. I think that kind of works against the idea that, well, everybody who's young and healthy gets the stuff, but it's just like the common cold. They have the sniffles, they take something and they're back at work the next day.
There's a very big difference between sort of over the top fear and sort of honest transparency for someone who's gone through it. And yeah. I'm with you. I, you know, having covered media a long time, there is immense value in very well-known people describing things that have happened to them that you can relate to. It's just, whether it's DeMar DeRozan or Kevin Love with mental health, or in this case, whether it's the Canucks with COVID, I'm one who believes that stuff actually has impact.
Tim and friends are right around the corner. Shai Davidi and James Sharman joins Tim. I think I have an idea what Sharman's going to talk about.
Yeah.
I think I have an idea. We'll talk about it a little bit ourselves. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, just a few minutes left before we hand you over to Tim and friends, Shai Davidi and James Sharman. Joining Tim, of course, James Sharman. Well, they're either going to be talking about Sharman's proper pies, which is Charmin's business. And a shout out to Charmin's Proper Pies, though, as well. Or they'll be talking about the new Super European Super League in soccer, which is essentially a breakaway league formed by all the teams you either really, really like or detest getting together and forming a breakaway league. Deitch, this is obviously, it's the biggest story in sports right now. It's getting obviously massive play overseas. I mean, the British government and now the royalty, now Prince William. Prince William, who is it? Was it Harry? Who are the other guys? I don't know my princes.
William and Harry is William is the guy who I think came out with the statement today.
Yeah. So Harry's the guy with,
Harry's living in the U.S.
Yeah. Megan, what's her name? So the Prince William is up in arms about this and Deitch, look, essentially what it is, it's the really wealthy, really powerful teams in Europe attempting to basically, I think, take control of one of the hottest TV properties out there. It's a property that last year brought $2.4 billion US, the Champions League. And I think, you know what's going to happen here? There's going to be, it's high stakes, it's high leverage, and eventually I think the clubs are going to get their way. And they will be guaranteed a pass. These 12 clubs will be guaranteed a pass every year into the Champions League. And, you know, money's going to talk eventually.
Yeah, the only thing I'll quickly say is, Jeff, it's like rooting for every villain, you know. FIFA, UEFA, like there's no good to root for except for the fans in this situation. But you are correct here that like this is all a big money attempt by those big clubs. I thought it was interesting, I know we're gonna run here, that the two big German clubs declined to be part of it, which is just really interesting to me given, you know, especially Bayern is one of the best clubs in the world, but they went out very publicly and said, we don't think this is good for our league. That was interesting to me.
Tim and Friends are next. Have a great night.